First thing I do is I already have the suction in my hand, suction, 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 lift up the tongue, move the suction to the left side of the mouth, grab my second suction if it's available, and go ahead and get that down there as well. Clear, 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 and then execute those other steps. Occipital head lift. Hey, so-and-so, put your fingers on the larynx. Good. Move it around. Excellent. Next. All right. Reach for my bougie. I have it right here. Bougie goes in. Like those things, actually saying those things out loud or just in your head, those steps can be super helpful because it blocks out a lot of the negative self-thought, like, oh, like what happens if this doesn't go well? Oh my gosh, I'm screwing it up.
Welcome to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast with me, your host, firefighter paramedic Kevin Grange. And on the episode today, we'll be talking about emergency reflex action drills and performance under pressure with Dr. Mike Laria. Mike was a pararescueman, or PJ, in the U.S. Air Force and a critical care flight paramedic for the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Advanced Response Team. Now he's an emergency medicine physician at the University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center, an EMS critical care fellow, a flight physician, and the associate medical director for Lifeguard Air Emergency Services. Welcome to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast, Mike.
Oh man, thank you guys so much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, I get a lot of providers who, you know, reach out to me and say, you know, do I have any advice for their career? And one thing I like to tell them is that as healthcare providers, we should always think of ourselves as expert learners. And so not try to be the expert, but always to have that understanding that we're always learning and to be an expert learner. And towards that, I like the idea of just really having great mentors and great role models. And so I've admired your work and been inspired by your work for a bunch of years now. So I'm really excited to speak with you today.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's really nice to hear that. And I'm glad it's helping some people out.
Great. So I like to kind of get started with what got you interested in medicine. And the pararescue and the PJs are kind of known as the silent professionals. Not a lot of people know they exist. So maybe you could explain more about the program, how you qualified, what you learned, and the type of work you did.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got into it somewhat reluctantly and kind of stayed in medicine. I wouldn't say reluctantly, but sort of serendipitously, I guess, in a sense. I started out actually ski patrolling when I was like 18, because, as it turns out, I loved skiing and I raced growing up competitively. And as it turns out, to really, you know, do that and make any kind of money or even stay on a collegiate team, you need this thing called talent. And, I wasn't that good, but I wanted to keep on skiing and figure out a way to do it for free. And so I became a ski patroller and then just like fell in love with the medicine and the rescue kind of stuff and joined the fire department. And I actually lived in the fire department for a while in college. And when it came time to graduate and decide what I wanted to do, one of my fire captains had told me like, hey, you know, like if you're interested in really like making a career out of technical rescue and pre-hospital medical stuff, you should check out this thing called pararescue with the Air Force. They used to come up to New Hampshire and train. I knew a bunch of these guys and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, the Air Force, what? Like, not a big fan of taking instructions from people, not a big fan of wearing a uniform, like not a big fan of, you know, that kind of stuff in general. But I looked into it and it seemed super cool. And so I went to a recruiter who thought I was crazy and wanted, I was like, don't you want to be like a pilot or an engineer or a lawyer or doctor or something? And I was like, no, I want to do this. And then enlisted in 2005 and made it through the pipeline. I think we started out with 70 something and we graduated. I think six of us ultimately graduated, finished the pipeline out of that starting class, which was pretty typical back then. I don't know what the numbers look like right now. And went on to work at the 321st Special Tactics Squadron, which is over in the UK, and had an amazing but very, very busy career, as you can imagine, between like 2007, 2008, and 2011. It was the operational tempo is really high. and spent most of my career actually working with other services by and large. So I was deployed to Iraq and worked with the Rangers and various other organizations in the special operations community. And then I was with the first of the 10th Special Forces Group over in Germany and did a whole bunch of things with various other organizations. And it was just a blast. And then got out and worked, did some educational stuff for a while, and then really kind of fell in love with things when I was flying at DART. I had a number of mentors at the program, and then some of our physicians in the hospital who were like, you just stop being such a weenie and just like take the MCAT and apply to medical school, you know, if you really like it this much. And I was like, fine. And then I got in and used the GI Bill to get through school. And next thing you know, here I am in New Mexico.
That's amazing. And one thing I like to say is medicine's kind of like this river that people, you know, jump into, and it sort of sweeps them along. And so what I find inspiring about your story is just the variety of places you've practiced medicine on the ski hill, on the battlefield, in the emergency department, up in the air on the helicopter. And so I just love that. You know, it's kind of like we can create the careers we want, and we don't have to necessarily like limit it to one. So really inspired by that.
Yeah, exactly.
So as you know, I'm a paramedic on the ambulance. You work in the emergency department up in the air. We deal with stress all the time. So we have, you know, unexpected patient volume. You know, the numbers could be super high one shift. The acuity is always changing. We might not have a full history on a patient. We have that sleep disturbance, you know, that circadian rhythm disturbances, you know, just general life stresses. So we're always, we have this stress. And so today we're going to kind of focus on two tactics that you've sort of created to deal with that stress. So why don't we go ahead and start with the emergency reflex action drills, and maybe you could explain those and how you came up with that.
Yeah, so reflex action drills were kind of a term that I used to, or came up with and kind of planted in the world of emergency medicine and ICU that were not completely unknown to emergency medicine and critical care medicine. Just kind of, I'd like to think of them as rebranding them, because I think in the military, in our world, especially like in very, very high risk situations, so like the fire service, and this is, you know, there's a lot of tension sometimes between EMS and the fire world, but they're very, I think, mutually informative. And this is one of those ways. And that is that you run into these situations where we actually train people, we drill people to execute very specific skills in a very focused manner very quickly, because we know empirically that if you have a particular situation, chances are these are the main problems, or this is what you're going to encounter. And those situations either unfold so quickly or are so dangerous and life-threatening that we train people to execute these skills essentially empirically. You could argue in a sense without really thinking about it. And so there's a litany of examples. I mean, we see it in the military specifically. We have immediate action drills. When you come into contact with an enemy force, we drill specifically what you do under those circumstances, because you don't have time to sit there getting shot at in the middle of a street or a field or a forest or whatever and have a caucus about what your plan is going to be, right?
Sure.
And debate like what we're going to do. You have to act essentially immediately. And the same thing is true. I mean, there's a whole host of examples in the fire service. There's examples in even like recreational sports, where like if you're climbing, we teach people like emergency arrest procedures, because you're not going to sit there sliding down the side of a mountain and be like, I wonder what I could do here. Should I stop this? Or how steep am I? How much longer do I have to live? You know, like you just do it.
Sure.
Same thing is true in aviation. And I think same thing should be true in medicine. A lot of the paradigms that we teach people in terms of like diagnosis and management, whether you're an EMT or whether you're a trauma surgeon or an emergency physician or an ICU physician, a lot of the times they're predicated on, I won't call it an antiquated, but sort of we'll say, like, optimized time model, when you can, like, sit there and you can scratch your head and you can kind of do some tests and send some labs and get an x-ray and then act, right? I think people, especially in acute care specialties, whether you're a paramedic or you're an anesthesiologist, you're a trauma surgeon, you're an emergency physician, we know that we've encountered situations where, like, you have to, like, act now. Like, you won't have all the information. You're acting with diagnostic uncertainty. I don't have a chest x-ray or a CT scan, but unless I act quickly, this person's going to die. And the risk benefit of maybe not getting the diagnosis 100% correctly, or maybe doing an invasive procedure when it wasn't 100% needed, may be outweighed by the benefit, and may exceed the benefit of that may exceed the risk of just sitting there and kind of, like, you know, thinking about it before acting. And so I think what we did was we came up with like ERADS. And when I tell people, it's like stop, drop, and roll for, like, emergency medical procedures, right?
Sure.
We teach it to kids because, yeah, exactly, man. Like, you're not going to sit there and teach, like, a little kid, now, Johnny, check and make sure you're not actually on fire. You know, like, think about doing this and think about calling for help and find your parent. Oh, like, stop, drop, and roll, man. And it's the same thing. You keep it simple. You minimize the cognitive effort. And what I tell people, because people in medicine, if you're like, don't think about something, just do something, they, like, lose their mind.
Sure.
What I explain to people is, like, you're doing the thinking ahead of time, right? So a couple of the examples I use are, like, airway stuff. So, for example, if you stick the laryngoscope into someone's mouth and you don't see anything, or, you know, you see all you can see is tongue, like, you don't have time always to exactly troubleshoot things and, you know, take a whole series of steps to improve oxygenation and ventilation and get the tube in. So what we do is we teach people, you know, or I'll teach some of the residents and I'll teach other people to optimize that view very, essentially quickly and empirically, like occipital head put or head lift, right, to optimize the angle. Go ahead and use bimanual laryngoscopy, so not like the whole burp thing, but just like have someone put their finger there and you manipulate it, and then grab a bougie. And those three things together, there's pretty good evidence that they'll either optimize your glottic view or help you achieve intubation. And now the addition of that is I'll add video laryngoscopy in there, for, especially for some of the newer residents or people who are less experienced. And I think those things, if you do the thinking ahead of time, be like, these things I've shown to help. Under these circumstances, you string them together and execute them quickly, they are very likely to help you very quickly improve your glottic view. And there's a whole host of other ones that you can that you could potentially come up with, and everything from, you know, ECMO to trauma scenarios. The point is that under certain very time sensitive situations, you do all the thing ahead of time, you come up with a specific set of skills or steps to execute very quickly, and you teach that to people over and over again, so that they, when they recognize or pattern recognize or identify the situation, they can execute it essentially without thinking.
Sure. Yeah, I love that. And as I was reading some of the ERADS for, you know, difficult airway, sudden drop in blood pressure, you know, cardiovascular collapse and ECMO, deterioration on a ventilator, I noticed a lot of them sort of had around three steps. When providers are thinking of making their own, do you suggest limiting it to, you know, 3 to 4 steps just to kind of get that quick baseline?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think keeping it simple, it's not keep it simple, stupid. It's keeping it simple is smart. And limiting the number of steps is good. The number of steps is debatable. A lot of people point to like 7. Was it based on, I believe it was Miller who wrote the paper. It was called The Magic Number 7 Plus or Minus 2. And it's basically like how many numbers someone could remember or keep on hand, right? Those are discrete pieces of information. It's pretty simple, right? Like, remembering a phone number is a little bit different from, you know, remembering the steps of intubation, or more complex cognitive and technical skills. So it's very little evidence in this particular zone. But I basically say, look, the magic number 7 minus 2 is 5. I got 5 fingers. So sure. Like 3 to 5 steps is optimal in my mind. However, I don't have like strong evidence to prove it. Sure. But keeping it short.
Yeah, I almost see the ERADS as, you know, maybe they're buying you those first few moments or minutes till you can get out that checklist, maybe a difficult airway checklist or, you know, whatever it is. So, after I read your paper, this really informed my care. What I've seen on the ambulance is sometimes providers think themselves out of diagnosis. And so with, say, allergic reaction or anaphylactic, they'll say, oh, you know, the patient's short of breath, but he doesn't have oral swelling, or his blood pressure's low, but he doesn't have wheezes. And so I've seen people and have been guilty of it myself, you know, where I get that sort of paralysis by analysis. But now that we've sort of got these emergency reflex action drills for anaphylaxis, it kind of takes some of that paralysis out. We'll see that patient with, you know, the oral swelling, and I'll just say, hey, the allergic reaction protocol. And my team will know that means, you know, IM epi, get an IV, Benadryl, Solumedrol. So it kind of kicks us into high gear and then reduces that cognitive load, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then another thing it does is it kind of creates that sterile cockpit. So in this high acuity case, there's not a bunch of people talking at once. Everyone already knows what to do. So I really appreciate that as well. And other ones we've used on the ambulance is, you know, a trauma protocol, mm-hmm. you know, which means basically 2 IVs, TXA, you know, fluid to kind of titrate to that mental status, or BP of 90, fentanyl for pain. And then another one, is on these critical patients, you know, we have this 2 IV attempts and then drill, or maybe 1 IV attempt and drill.
Yeah.
And that kind of
good. Yes.
Yeah. That kind of came from a call we had where we attempted 7 IVs and we showed up at the ED without an IV. And then I read your paper and I was just like, okay, this is let's make an ERAD for these critical patients. And it's 1 IV, 2 IV attempts, and then just go ahead and get that IO.
I was just going to say, I think it's super, super useful under circumstances that you laid out. And for a couple reasons, like you said, a lot of the time we get paralyzed by our analysis of the situation. Oh my gosh, if there's a couple situations, like medicine is one, technical rescue is another. I have never seen more debate over like rescue systems, that, you know, time wasted to talking about like how you're going to rig a system instead of just be like, dude, there's like 7 different ways we can do it. Just pick one and let's sure. just do it. And in medicine is very similar. The other thing that you pointed out is errors of commission or omission. This is something we've talked about. There's good literature on it. We've talked about it in medicine for sure. Is that we're like scared to act sometimes because we're afraid that like our interventions are going to do damage, or we're going to do them wrong, or we're going to get yelled at or for doing something that we probably shouldn't have, or whatever. And I think others have hypothesized this as well, although I cannot prove it. I think we do a not insignificant amount of harm to people by exactly like you said, like talking your way out of it and trying to avoid doing something that's actually indicated by finding reasons not to do it. And I think that's really unfortunate. It's common though. And I get it too, because I've been in that same exact position, both in the field, on the side of a highway, on a boat, in a helicopter, like you name it. And you're like, oh, do I really want to do this? Oh, sure. But it's okay. Like his stats only, like give him a couple more minutes, you know, like try this, right. Give him a little more fluid. And then like half hour later, you're like, oh crap. Like I should have just, this is not getting better. I should have intervened earlier. And I think that these skills actually help lower that initiation threshold, but also lower the threshold to quickly kind of solve the problem. And the last piece, and this is something that I think we really need to work on, is we kind of pride ourselves in medicine on being smart and being able to figure things out and being diagnostic gurus and understanding some of these things. But the fact is that, like, especially in acute care situations, yeah, some of the time things are pretty cut and dry and the diagnosis is pretty clear. You can make it clinically, the bedside, the roadside, but a lot of the times it's not. And the same is true with how we teach people to either address or troubleshoot things. My favorite one is like the DOPES mnemonic for like troubleshooting like ventilator stuff, right? The way we teach people to do it is like consider or think about displacement, consider obstruction. And then we list out all these things that could be obstructing it. Like the better approach, in my opinion, from like a cognitive science standpoint, is to teach people to do things that will empirically address those issues without like encouraging them to think more. For a couple of reasons, from a cognitive science standpoint, that's actually really hard to do when someone's like actively dying and you're really stressed out. The cognitive bandwidth you have is pretty low. Two, your diagnostic ability and the ability for you to like pull information out of your brain to come up with a diagnosis or remember diagnostic criteria is harder when you're super stressed. And finally, using far transfer, coming up with novel solutions or problem solving capability when your bandwidth is really limited and you're super stressed out is also really, really hard under those situations. And so what you do is, so like, for example, I tell people with the DOPE stuff, instead of teaching people like DOPES, if you want to teach them that acronym, fine, but it should be like displacement. Immediately look for end tidal CO2 and make sure that there's air going in and out, either on the vent or you can feel it, right? Obstruction, just stick the suction down the tube, right? Especially like in the ICU setting, it's already hooked up in line. So we just stick it down. If you hit an obstruction, guess what? It's obstructed, right?
Sure.
Now you kind of know and you can fix it and address it. Pneumothorax, don't like tell people think about a pneumothorax. Well, just get the damn ultrasound, put the ultrasound on someone's chest and look for pneumothorax. Or if you happen to have a chest x-ray immediately available, fine, cool, whatever. But you should be empirically doing these simple, relatively non-invasive things that can help you act and rule out these things at the same time. The last reason why I think changing that paradigm into a more eRADS-y type paradigm is important is because actually when you start doing things, once you get involved in doing stuff, your brain is much less likely to think like, get super stressed out and go, oh, well, like, what if I go to RSI this person? I paralyze them. I can't get the tube in. They're really fat. There's lots of blood. Like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? And you start moving in a direction, your brain becomes like goal oriented and focused. You have this sense of like internal locus of control. You can control the outcome. You're doing things to mitigate the outcome. And there's also this sense of like, we kind of call it the snowball effect. Like once you do something effectively, you are more likely to continue to doing things effectively. It's like, oh yeah, it's like these mini wins in your brain. It's like, yeah, man. Yeah, like I can do this. I'm on track. And so you're more likely to actually achieve a successful outcome when you are task focused and doing specific things, as opposed to being like, well, think about all this stuff, which leads to more paralysis by analysis than actually focused specific things that will help you solve the problem, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. And I love that emphasis on just taking action, you know, and having it pre-planned like you suggest. All right. So that leads us into the second part of our podcast today. And it's kind of all merging into one, which is, you know, how we deal with stress. So you and your team will kind of present this in sort of a case scenario. You have your emergency reflex action drills. You've gone over it. So we'll pretend you're a little bit younger than you are and newer into your career. And it's the middle of a busy shift. The charge nurse notifies you that emergency medical services, EMS, is 4 minutes out with a 35-year-old patient with a stab wound to the chest. And that patient has just lost his pulse. You experience an immediate knot in your stomach, and you can feel your heart pounding. You have not performed a thoracotomy in more than 10 years, and that time was merely assisting the trauma surgeons during residency. The nearest surgeon is 15 minutes away at home. You realize that the thoracotomy has to happen, and your stress response will keep you from optimizing performance. So, Mike, we've all had these moments of this difficult case or patient presenting themselves to us. What are some tips? How can we deal with that?
Yeah, so that's a great one. I think this really kind of came about when I was in the military and kind of started looking at this. And we came up with this mnemonic that we called BTSF, so Beat the Stress Fool, because, and I'll explain more about that and where it came from and what it stands for, but we came up with it basically looking at like all the performance science literature, which was crazy because like, if you think about it, like in medicine, it's like totally siloed sometimes. There's all of this literature, like on education and all of this literature on performance science and psychology and cognitive science. And for a long time, with the exception of a couple pockets, I think we completely ignored it. Right. Sure. And I think looking at a lot of that data and evidence kind of led us down the track of, well, how could we make that practical in medicine? Because I don't know if you guys have had this, but we've definitely had people, and I've seen this, like you have like performance coaches and psychologists come in and start talking to you. And they're like, well, you know, if you think someone's dying, you know, what you should probably do first is try to ground yourself. And so hold on to a chair or a rock. And you're like, a rock in the ICU or the emergency? Like, you clearly have no idea, like, what we do, what we have to deal with, man. Like, can you imagine, like, hopping out of the helicopter or, like, the ambulance, being like, this guy's dying. Hey, can we all, like, hold hands and, like, have a moment of peace and, like, hum and, you know, we'll ground ourselves. We'll sit on the ground and we'll remind ourselves that we're okay. Like, no, that's, like, absurd, dude. Like, you cannot do that. So the biggest thing was, like, going through all that performance science and, like, how do you do it in the moment, or what actually, like how it lines up with either pre-hospital or in the ED or in the ICU. One of the nice things is like in the scenario you presented, it's pretty common. Like you generally get a heads up. Sometimes we get these like homie drop-offs, or sometimes you're just presented with things that like happen right in front of you, like hyper-acute trauma. We saw it in the military, like walking along and someone like next to you gets shot and like things go south, like uber fast. But by and large, especially like in EMS and EM and the ICU, you get a little bit of a heads up, which gives you time to prepare at least a couple minutes. And that's really all you need sometimes. And so that was the whole impetus, taking all the evidence and like our experience and like turning it into this product that you could use. And the way I'd use it, like especially in this scenario, is the BTSF stuff. So breathe, talk, see, and focus. And it took one of my amazing Australian friends to bring up the Beat the Stress Fool thing, which is funny because, like, you know, he's like Mr. T in the A-Team. I was like, what? He's like, you know, he's like, I pity the fool. I was like, oh, it's funny that, like, it took an Australian to point that out to me, especially considering I love the A-Team. But sure. Yes, we'll take it. And it stands for, like I said, breathe, talk, see, focus. And these are like four skills that I think you could use basically in the moment to help calm you down and focus you and prepare you to do what you have to do. So breathe is basically like controlled breathing and controlled cyclic breathing, which has been known to various Eastern arts since like the dawn of time. Sure. And only recently have we actually like studied it. But interestingly enough, if you look at like your entire autonomic response and your autonomic nervous system, breathing is really one of the only things you can really control, right? You can't control, like you can't like mentally wish your blood pressure to be better. But you can like hold your breath. And what we see is that controlled cycle, some people call it tactical breathing, some people call it box breathing, some people call it performance breathing, whatever you want to call it, seems to actually like blunt the downstream effects of sympathetic activation or increase in sympathetic tone and activation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, that big like adrenaline dump that you get. And all you're basically doing is taking a breath in for like 3 or 4 seconds, holding it for 3 or 4 seconds, letting it out for 3 or 4 seconds, and then holding it out for 3 or 4 seconds. And again, if anybody's done like martial arts or yoga or meditation, this is actually, you know, it's not that difficult to learn how to do. And especially in those moments, like those lulls, like you're pulling out of station and your partner's driving and, you know, you have like a couple minutes to get there. Yes, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, suggest like closing your eyes and taking deep breaths is like you're clearing the road and like helping him get where you go safely. But there's definitely moments there where you can be focused and you can exercise those breathing things. Like I'll do it as I'm standing there, like waiting. I have the advantage of the emergency department, the ICU, of people bring the patients to me, which is a nice change. So like I can do it while I'm waiting for those patients, or even in like those moments, like one of the craziest moments that's like hardest to, for me to like not do things, like Ricky Bobby with my hands, like don't do anything, just like calm down, take a deep breath, is like those times when we're RSIing someone and like you push the drugs, and in like while you're waiting for like the drugs to take effect, that 30 seconds to a minute can seem like an eternity, but you can get some really good breaths in, and that's like a really good opportunity for that. So as once I got this call, it's probably what I'd go set up the room, do all my usual stuff from a clinical preparation standpoint, and I'd probably start taking a couple breaths. So self-talk is actually one of the most interesting things to me, which is this idea of cognitive reframing. So what you say to yourself can actually change your frame of reference. That frame of reference is really important because the entire stress response, at least as far as we understand it from an academic standpoint now, is predicated on your perception of whether or not you have the faculties and the ability to successfully achieve the outcome, whether your resources meet the demands of the situation or not. And as it turns out, that's a perceptual thing, right? So if you're like, oh my gosh, I haven't treated a kid in a while, or oh my gosh, like last time I had a bad, you know, COPD or whatever, it didn't go so well. Like those are all perceptual things. You can change that perception using your own internal dialogue. Like, okay, like the last one didn't go pretty well because of this, this, and this. This person right now really needs my help. I know like I can manage someone who's in respiratory stress, or I know like I can manage someone who's in hemorrhagic shock. These are the main things that I have to do. I can do those things. And people have even gone so far as to like put them into individual steps. And at least from my standpoint, that's super helpful because a lot of what we do is procedural, right? So I'll actually tell myself, like that's part of the self-talk I use is not just like little engine that could, like you can do this, Mike, get in there, like this person needs you, but it's like focused on those individual steps of a procedure. So whether I'm putting in a central line or I'm putting in a chest tube, or I like feel that like drop in my throat when like I get the laryngoscope in there and go to intubate someone, I can't see anything. Right? Sure. Or it's just like this Vesuvius of blood or vomit coming out at me. Like having those steps of like, okay, like see Vesuvius and vomit. First thing I do is I already have the suction in my hand, suction, lift up the tongue, move the suction to the left side of the mouth, grab my second suction if it's available and go ahead and get that down there as well. Clear, and then execute those other steps. Occipital head lift. Hey, so-and-so, put your fingers on the larynx. Good. Move it around. Excellent. Next. All right, reach for my bougie. I have it right here. Bougie goes in. Like those things, actually saying those things out loud or just in your head, those steps can be super helpful because it blocks out a lot of the negative self-thought, like, oh, like what happens if this doesn't go well? Oh my gosh, I'm screwing it up. And it's like all your brain hears is your brain telling itself the next step. And so that self-talk and reframing, super helpful.
First of all, I love the mnemonic beat the stress fool. And I find with mnemonics, if they can be a little whimsical like this, you know, hey, maybe I smile when I say it, I'm actually starting to relax just by thinking about it.
Whereas, oh, like, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. The AEIOU tips, you know, few people can remember it because it's not really grounded in something that's funny or whimsical. Yeah. So I love this. And then I was thinking, again, I read this paper and it really helped, you know, my patient care. I do a ton of yoga, but like you say, when you can't just bust out a warrior one or warrior two in the middle of an emergency, so you need other tactics. With the self-talk, what I hear a lot of people saying, you know, when we're practicing, say, surgical crikes, is I keep hearing them say, hey, I hope this never happens. Hope this never happens. And I try to tell them, you know, after reading this article, instead of saying, I hope it never happens, because then if it does, you're going to like, you'll be thinking internally, what I hope never would happen is now happening. Say, hey, when it happens, I'll be ready. You know, just kind of reframing that. So, hey, when this happens, I'll be ready for it. And so I love this idea of we learn the skills for, you know, intubation, chest tubes, but we also need the mindset to go along with it, which I think 100%. Is what this mnemonic does. All right, so I'm breathing, I'm working on my breath. Maybe it's the box breathing, maybe it's just a 3-second kind of mini meditation right before you walk in the room. I've got the positive self-talk. What else can I do to provide the best patient care?
Yeah, the next step is, or the next thing I think is C. And especially this is wild in my mind. It has some of the coolest science behind it. Like just by thinking through the steps and like imagining yourself doing the steps. And we actually teach this to athletes like all the time, right? These psychomotor skills. You can essentially simulate access to the same neurological architecture almost as actually doing it. And we think this because we've done studies where other people have done studies that actually look at functional MRI scans of the brain of someone, like, for example, thinking about playing the piano versus actually playing a piece of music on the piano. And almost the exact same parts of the brain light up. So just by like imagining like the procedure that you have to do either shortly before or immediately before or as you're doing it, it's basically like running your mental simulator multiple times. It's like the cheapest and fastest way to practice doing something without actually having anything available to you. So like for trauma in particular, like if depending upon the scenario that I hear, I will run through in my head some of like the key skills, and I will think about, especially if it's like essentially guaranteed, like someone who's bad trauma coming in that's not breathing, chances are they're very much going to need an airway. So I'll like think about like as I'm setting things up, like as I'm touching things and actually like putting them where I want them or getting out the bag if we're on the helicopter, I'll be thinking about the exact steps of preparation and execution in my head. So by the time I'm actually doing it, I've already done it like half a dozen times in my head. So that skill just very naturally unravels, almost like breathing. It's not 100%. You're always, you can never 100% simulate the anatomy of someone who's maybe a little bit fluffier or someone who may have difficult airway anatomy. But by and large, going through those steps is super helpful.
Yeah. And we've incorporated this at our agency. So we're driving to a cardiac arrest. We'll start assigning roles in route. So You're on airway, you're on IO and meds, you're on cardiac monitor, you're on compressions. And so as we're driving to the call, people are already beginning to visualize those steps. And yeah, it's had great success with our agency. So
nice.
So we've done all this and we have this high acuity call and I still feel a little bit of stress. What else can I do?
Yeah. So especially when it comes time, one of the I think things we think we run into, and you've totally pointed this out earlier, right? The threshold to do something sometimes can be very high. And we say this kind of dogmatically, for example, with surgical airways, like you pointed out too, people like hope they don't have to do it. They never want to do it. We always say the hardest part of actually doing it is the decision to do it. Right.
True. Yeah.
And often, again, like I said, the hardest part is getting started on something. Like once you get going with your assessment, the assessment will flow because you've done it a billion times. Once you get going on starting the IV, like you've done so many IVs that just doing it is not necessarily always the problem, but getting going can be. And so that last piece, and oh, by the way, there's some very cool literature on this looking at like stress and cortisol and heart rate variability, like before someone does an airway, as they're about to start an airway. And then as soon as they start manipulating the airway, that heart rate variability drops like very, very suddenly and precipitously, which is telling me that like their brain is less concerned about things and they're less stressed because they're so focused on what they're doing, is that last piece, is focus. So it's basically coming up with a word or like a keyword or keyword or it could be a short phrase theoretically that transitions you from like thinking in preparation to actually doing stuff. And the word that I actually use is focus. And to me, like I just train my brain to like, that's like my go word. It turns that switch in my head from like, all right, like you thought about this, you prepared about this, you've heard the report, go. And I think that's super helpful, because as soon as you like make it over that ledge, you get that initial activation energy to get going, you're going, and you're more likely to be successful, I think.
Sure. Yeah, no, I love it. And like I said, it's helped me in my practice immensely. So, well, I've really enjoyed speaking with you today. And if listeners want to get a hold of you, you know, with additional questions, or maybe they've come up with a few emergency reflex action drills, they want to run them by you, how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So you guys can always reach out to me. My Twitter handle is at Recess Padawan. And they can also hit me up on Facebook, or feel free. I always feel free to give my email out to everybody. It's at MJ Lauria, LAURIA, at Salud, SALUD.UNM.EDU.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And yeah, I learned a lot. And again, really appreciate everything you've done for emergency medicine.
Yeah, no worries, man. It was a pleasure talking with you, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me. And hopefully I'll see you and a whole bunch of other people at the conference.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.